into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot, don't shoot! Oh, what a goal from Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah. No, I'm...
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports. Ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
Right, time to turn to rugby. I'm so delighted to say Brian O'Driscoll is with us. Brian, good afternoon to you. How are you?
Sure, I'm terrific. How are you?
I'm good. We should fess up and say we're doing this on Thursday just in case there is a massive outbreak of COVID in the next 24 hours and suddenly the Champions Cup final gets cancelled. As it stands, they're all walking fine, hale and hearty and fit. And look, maybe we should start by previewing the game, or maybe we should talk about the state of the rest of the world of sports. Rugby's done quite well to get to where it's got to when you look at what has happened with football over the last couple of weeks.
Incredibly well. I think, you know, I was listening to Ron Nogara talking about his La Rochelle team and how few cases, I don't know if any cases have been reported from them and how diligent they've been. But yet, at the same time, how so much of it is about good fortune. You talk about people going to the supermarket, going about their daily business and thinking they're being diligent, but you just don't know where the virus is and where it's surviving. And obviously it doesn't limit itself to anyone. So that said, I think rugby has done very well. I think, you look inside, you know, particularly in Ireland and how few cases there have been comparatively to other countries. I think there has to be a pat on the back for the medical teams in all the four provinces, for the structures put in place, for how these games have managed to be played. But it's a precarious landscape that we're living in at the moment, and it feels that we're not far away from a potential outbreak and a stoppage in some games. So I think we might be living that way for a while yet.
That's the thing, isn't it? Like professional sport has that weird bubble anyway that everybody talked about before bubbles became de rigueur when it was talking about this. And now we're trying to see exactly how well that can hold up. And I think that anything that we can do to learn a bit more about how to live with this, then that's actually going to be valuable in the long run. In the meantime, it might look like you're experimenting when these are life and death scenarios and, you know, people are in the intensive care unit. So there's a very tricky balancing act to be seen, to be trying to do the right thing, and then also at the same time to try and go about life as best we possibly can.
Yeah, listen, you can see it in society. It's a polarized point of view as to what we do. It's the snapshot of, you know, potentially more deaths and more illness versus the, you know, falling economy. And if you look, whatever that opinion poll on the Claire Byrne last week, where it was 40 to 42 and 18% undecided as to what needs to happen, go to further lockdown or not. So it's a very polarized society that we're living in on this topic. And as a result, it's very hard to argue with the other side without thinking that there's some merit in what they have to say. While we are trying to navigate our way through all of this with rugby, we just have to continually be mindful that we're very lucky that we are getting to play the game at an elite level, that there is live rugby to be seen, albeit no crowds really going to games, say for the odd 100 or 200 people in Connacht last week or in Belfast also. But we have to, continue to be incredibly mindful as to everything that's going on outside of our little bubble as well of elite sport, because it's obviously a much bigger picture than just playing a game, but yet we need sport so badly as well to get us through some of these more challenging times too.
Yeah, and the other thing is that if the sports don't try and save themselves now, then there might not be much for them to try and rekindle when they go away, if they go away again. Like, we keep talking about the word existential, but that was the word that the IRFU used about the scenario. That was back in March when we kind of thought that maybe there might be crowds in November. Who knew at that stage that there might be no crowds next year either, you know?
There could very easily be no crowds. And it's going to be difficult to see how crowds are going to be re-emerging at games until we have this vaccine. That's the reality of it. There's no point in planning too far in advance because there's so many uncertainties coming week by week, day by day. So let's just deal with the here and now and try and tick each week off as we go. We're really lucky that this weekend we're managing to get to a Champions and Challenge Cup final. And then we kick into the real focus for everybody in Europe then to go towards next season's tournament and trying to get through as much as we possibly can. We already know that that's going to be a condensed, shortened version with different qualifying criteria, but needs must. And the malleability of different unions and different competitions has been really important to be able to adjust themselves to the circumstances they find themselves in. So hopefully we can continue going this way and just see out this incredibly hard part of time of life at the minute for many people, but realize the importance of what sport can add a little bit of respite to people's kind of downtrodden feeling at the minute.
What's your sense of the different nations talking to each other about potentially a redrawn calendar? Because again, at the start of the whole chat, this seemed like something was imminent, and then that disappeared again. But recently, there's kind of stuff bubbling up again. You know, we see the whole South African country, the teams joining the pro, whatever it's going to be at the end of that. That seems like there are big conversations happening all around the world between unions at the moment.
Yeah, they clearly do. And it's a lot of he said, she said, and there's different media reportings week by week. And in many ways, what the New Zealand Rugby Union decided to do almost did it make South Africa's mind up for them? They realize a lot of the power and a lot of the money is in Northern Hemisphere rugby, and they want to get in on a slice of that action. And I think that's probably a smart perspective, besides all of the travel implications to playing Super Rugby and playing Rugby Championship, which has knocked them sideways for years. The simple time zone of playing in Europe makes sense alone. And add to that a huge number of South African players playing in Europe. Add to it, those financial possibilities that come with that. It seems as though all things are pointing in the direction of a move up north. And as World Cup champions, they're in a very powerful position. Never will they be playing with a stronger hand. So now is the time for deliberations and trying to find a happy medium for themselves and for a potential inclusion in European competition and who knows, maybe potentially even Six Nations competition down the line.
It seems like a fairly obvious step at that point. It would be weird almost if it didn't follow.
Yeah, I think it would. I think it's going to be very hard for them to head back down to Super Rugby at this stage. I think that die has been cast New Zealand, Australia are going to be doing their own thing. And now South Africa have found themselves in limbo, but with great opportunities. So, the Southern Kings and the Cheetahs hasn't really worked because they've been, weak franchises in the Pro 14. For the first year, the Cheetahs were trying to hedge their bets on two fronts, playing in South Africa in the Currie Cup and playing Pro 14, which is kind of crazy in itself. But yet, if you look at the potential for the other provincial teams then in South Africa to come into a Pro 14 or a Pro 16, I think it would strengthen the competition from lots of points of view because you could not send down a second string Munster, Ulster or Leinster down to the Stormers stacked with their internationals and expect to get a result. Whereas you were able to get away with that with the Southern Kings and with the Cheetahs because of the lack of quality there. That will not be the case in Durban or at the Lions or with the Stormers. So I think it would solve lots of problems for South Africa, but it would definitely solve some problems in the necessity of European and Irish teams needing to play their best players more often. And I think that's a bone of contention with French and English teams, is that, you know, the likes of Leinster are able to win the domestic league, the Pro 14, with a second string, kind of 60-70% of the time. Well, that won't be the case if there's kind of a promotion and a relegation out of the Pro 16. And also if automatic European selection is all of a sudden taken away from them because of the inclusion of these South African teams.
Yeah, and look, this is a constant debate. When Leinster do really well in Europe, the English and French are complaining about it. When Leinster don't do well in Europe, it's because the league isn't strong enough, and, you know, swings and roundabouts here. And it's actually easy enough to argue both sides of that. You can see the evidence and make the case for both sides.
Well, yeah, you look at most recently, you know, were Leinster match hardened? No, they weren't. And was the intensity of the South Africa or the Saracens game anything like they had felt over the course of the previous year prior to St. James's Park playing them last time? And the answer is no. You know, they qualified for Europe after four rounds, the first time that's ever happened. And then we obviously had the huge break. And then, you know, we've subsequently seen this, you know, the standards of where Ulster and Munster are at the moment, still finding their feet, were nothing on the intensity that Saracens were able to offer. So on the basis of that, it worked against Leinster. And it just depends on the success or the shortcomings of any team that you can, you know, you can use the whip against them, and you can find a reason to kind of point towards your own side's shortcomings because of the criteria of a side being able to rest players, or they're on the flip side, a side not being hardened because they've rested too many players.
The English and the Welsh clubs better really be careful what they wish for, because if the South African side suddenly arrive up and start smashing everybody in Europe in a couple of seasons' time, I know they're not going to be in it straight away, but eventually they will be. And then it'll be like, well, you can't have the South Africans, not a European Cup anymore.
Yeah, but do you know what? Yeah, that's true. But I suppose whatever about, you know, from an English perspective, you look at the quality, not even necessarily the quality of the rugby, but you think about the esteem with which the Gallagher Premiership or the Top 14 is held. The reality is the Pro 14 is not held in the same regard. It's not. And we need to be able to have credibility on two fronts. Leinster's season is based on whether they win Europe or get to a European final. And yes, they won the Pro 14 this year, but they lost in the quarterfinal. Is that deemed a successful season? Probably not by their standards. It's not at the moment. Everything has always been judged on how you do in Europe. Matt O'Connor lost his job having won the Pro 14, or the Pro 12 as it was, in 2014, and almost got to a European final, other than a Jimmy Gopper drop goal shaving an upright. So everything is based on European success and how you do in that. We need to be able to fight on a second front and have an interest level to hold sponsors, to give an opportunity to younger players coming through, but also to have a credibility with regard from the French and English side that we do have a league absolutely worth winning, and you can't win it with your second team.
Yeah, and look, I think the South African teams are going to bring that, and they will bring the crowds, and they'll bring like a much deeper level of analysis from the Commoner Garden rugby fan who's suddenly like, oh, actually, hang on a second, they've got Sy Khaleesi playing this week. That's going to be pretty interesting. I'm going to go and see him. So let's talk about the game this weekend, because Exeter are one of those teams that a lot of people who are neutrals warm to. For people who aren't familiar with the Exeter story, why are there so many people's second team? Why do people actually like and respect what they've done?
I think they're a real... what is it about them? Well, first of all, they've kind of built themselves. They haven't built themselves on buying in Stardust. Yes, in the last year, they've managed to procure Johnny Gray and Stuart Hogg on punchy packages. But they have, first of all, they're the only team making a profit in the Premiership in the UK. And secondly, they've come through the ranks of lower divisions, and they're a relatively new team, eating at the top table. I played against them in their first European game in 2012. They'd only just qualified for the Premiership the year before, and straight away they qualified top six. And we thought, okay, here'd be a nice soft touch, you know, 5-pointer starting off in the RDS, defending our title. And we had to scrap for a 4-point victory. I think it was 13-8 or 13-9.
Classic.
And but it was still a good game. And I remember thinking, gosh, straight away they've got your respect. They've got your attention. They're not a pushover. They're not someone here, you know, they're not going to yo-yo up and down and vanish into obscurity. And then they built themselves on really good foundations. They've got a coach that doesn't lose a run of himself, who talks an awful lot of sense, who's kind of clear in the way he wants to play the game. And I think the way they try and play rugby now, with the bludgeon up front, with some of the stardust that they've managed to bring in, I think they just look as though they're a really nice package. And it's difficult to dislike them because they do all the right things visually, but also I think they seem to be quite a nice crew to deal with. And it's hard. It's one of those teams that's hard to dislike them.
The Racing victory over Saracens, everybody was giving out about the quality of the game. I thought it was quite interesting, actually, watching that Saracens team try and get over the line one last time. And there was something very compelling about that. It was kind of one of those old school sports stories where it's one last spin for this entire group before they break up under, we all know the circumstances of it, but for the moment of genius that beat them to be so spectacularly brilliant was like, this is high quality sport here. This is absolutely like a two proper heavyweights. This is Ali versus Frazier type stuff where it's genius at the very end that wins the game at the death.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a real typical arm wrestle game. Defenses on top, a lot of kicking, kind of forcing mistakes, and you did get the sense that it was a one try game, but also needed a moment of magic. And what I loved about the actual act in itself was the way that Racing lined it up. We've seen Finn Russell go to the chip game before, but I think sometimes it's been telegraphed where, you know, before he does it, you can see four guys outside him lining a lot flatter because they want to get on the offside line as he's kicking the ball. And the opposition immediately realize, mayday, mayday, there's a kick coming over the top. And that's easy pickings for a 13 or a blind winger to chase across. What they did on this occasion was they only told Vakatawa. I don't even know if Finn Russell told the rest of his players that he was going to chip it over. I think he'd had a word to Vakatawa. He was the only one charging. And what he did was the line looked as though he was just going to be screened, like the ball was going to be thrown out the back to him. Zeebo was animated, looking as though he's about to get it. I feel as though he expected to get it. Whereas Fakatawa and Finn Russell were the only two in the know. And we used to do that sometimes, playing certain moves, that we'd get guys, I'd talk to Johnny or to Raj, and you know, we'd call a play and then I'd give him a wink, which meant, you know, we'll do the opposite to that. But you'd get guys still running with the same enthusiasm to get the ball as they when they weren't getting it. And it's a subconscious thing that if you're not getting the ball, it's very hard to get your timing spot on, but also very hard to get your enthusiasm up to the same level as when you think you're going to be hit on the advantage line with it. So I think all of those things added to this being a perfect play. I think Elliot Daly was the one that probably needed to do a little bit better on Vakatawa, get in his running line, give away a penalty there potentially, but he's got to do a little bit more. But the skill to catch the ball, you know, and fend off, it was, I don't know, it was the scrum half, I think it was. And then the offload to Russell again and him off for the score was a thing of beauty. And a game that I personally struggled to watch. I thought it wasn't particularly exciting, even as an arm wrestle, but to have the deadlock broken with a play of such class and skill and execution will be remembered for a long time, provided they can win this weekend.
A lot of times the finals don't live up to the expectation because the two best teams are there and they frequently have done so much work on each other. Do you expect a good game, or is it more than likely going to be another arm wrestle?
It's hard to know. It really is, because Because of the crowd, because of the lack of a crowd, it's the first time I believe that Racing will have played in front of an empty stadium. I think they've had at least 1,000 fans in all of their games thus far. So I think, you know, there's been different studies done. There was a study done in the US Open where so many more underdogs came through and they didn't have to deal with the manipulation of the crowd getting on side of the more favored players. And they just had to play the tennis match. And I think if you look at individuals separately, some rely on emotion massively and feed off the crowd, and some are so insular in their way of thinking. Someone like Johnny Wilkinson just played in his own head and kind of didn't worry about outside factors, whereas lots of guys feed off the crowd for motivation and for improved performance. So it's whichever individuals and whichever teams can actually just focus on getting their game plan that they've practiced throughout the week on point and delivered as best they can. And, you know, they won't, you know, the big hits, they'll have to generate the sense of good feeling amongst themselves because they'll get nothing from the crowd. So it's really hard to call it as a game. I think because it's in Bristol, I think I'd slightly favour Exeter, but I've seen quite a lot of them, and I think Racing are not, they're very, if it was in France, I think Racing would be a nigh on impossible team to beat. But the fact that it's in Bristol, I think that just gives Exeter the edge, but I'd anticipate it'll be a close one.
Can I just ask you about Ireland before we wrap up here? The injuries that we've seen already, Baird is out and obviously Larmour is out. These are two massive games really from Andy Farrell's perspective for all sorts of different reasons. The prize money for the Six Nations has never been more important to the IRFU than it is right now. So there's no sense that he was going to be going experimenting. But at the same time, putting Ryan Baird in the team doesn't really feel like that much of an experiment anymore. That's how quickly he's reached the point where we're all very excited about seeing him. In terms of what happens with Larmour, who is now in the box seat for the number 15 spot? Or is anybody actually an out-and-out replacement for him at 15? Does he start thinking about his whole backfield trio makeup?
Yeah, it's a good question. It was really hard to if you look at Larmour being moved to the wing, the last couple of weeks, the start of the new season, after how he got on towards the end of last year's competitions, he struggled in the air in particular. So, you know, was he in contention to be the starting fullback again? Of course he was, but I think there were still huge question marks as to who was going to start back there. It probably was going to be him. With Stockdale playing there a little bit more, he's showed good points and some pretty disappointing aspects of his performance so far this season. So I don't think there's anyone that's very cut and dry as to who's going to replace him. You could take a punt on, are they going to take a punt on Hugo Keenan coming in at 15 against Italy? I don't think so. Shane Daly, no. So I think you're going to go with a tried and tested international player. And that's why, for me, I think Stockdale probably is the one that looks as though he's going to get the 15 jersey. I believe Keith Earls is struggling a little bit. I'm not sure whether he's going to be available or not for these games. So almost through that elimination, the process of elimination, it seems as though it's going to be Stockdale, Conway, and then, you know, with the inclusion of one more, whereas previously it was going to be Earls and Larmour in the mix. So it was almost a bit like, you know, yesteryear with Leinster when you had Easton Asiwa, Rob Kearney, Luke Fitzgerald and Shane Horgan. Over the course of that season in 2011, 2012, someone always was injured. So coaches never had to get to that really tough decision as to leave someone out. And I suppose in some way that's been a bit fortuitous for Andy Farrell that he doesn't have that headache, but it's the sort of headache you want to have when you're talking about quality operators like Larmour being gone for a concerted period of time. But will we see James Lowe feature potentially in the next few games? You know, he's just been brought in as a training player, but I'm struggling to think about who else is going to come in and potentially take over from what looks like maybe two injuries.
Yeah, is Conway's best position actually full back at international level, or is there a sense?
I don't think he's got the kicking game for it. I really don't. Obviously, he's very good in the air, but you know, he he's predisposed to running the ball an awful lot, and that's what the crowd will love. But international rugby's not, it's about weighing up your options, and you get punished for making bad decisions in that regard. I think where Rob Kearney, even when he decided that he was going to have a run, it wasn't the right option. He was brilliant at breaking the first tackle, and so he bought time for the reinforcements to come and clear the ball. Conway's powerful, but he's not the same sort of powerful. So if he runs into a dark hole, I think he can get eaten up. And that's why the likes of Stockdale, with his size, he can turn a bad decision into a good decision. He's less issues with understanding the defensive system playing in the 15 jersey. People were pulling him apart for his performance against Chez and Kobe. I would not hold that against him in the Toulouse game. You know, it's just anyone would be left to hung out to dry there. Whereas at 15, at least you know you're the last man. You got to make your tackle. You don't have to make any decisions. You just know what your tackle is, and you make it or you don't make it. So maybe that's a situation that they put him into rather than trying to bring in a defensive decision scenario for him to go, okay, you were trying to take the first four, or we're playing hard up and there's something going on the front door and there's something going on the back door. That's where he lost his confidence in the World Cup, and I'm not sure he's back to his 2018 confidence of being able to read plays well. So maybe that, all those things adding up, might be a smart play in playing him in the 15 jersey and see how he gets on.
Are there any other options? Because it was obviously a completely different regime that had Robbie Henshaw at fullback, and with Mike Catt in the environment, do they start to look at maybe having another out half at 15? And obviously there aren't a huge number of options there. Like, is that off the table for now? Might we see it in November?
I think so. I think it is off the table. I think you might see Hugo Keenan. I've been really, really impressed with him. I've liked Shane Daly. I'll be honest, I haven't seen a huge amount of him, but he's looked very compact. I think that the exciting thing about Hugo Keenan is he looks as though he's pretty good in the air. His kicking game definitely needs a lot of work, but he has this explosiveness to him where it looks as though he can make something happen from the back. And, you know, I know, you know, looking, you know, listening to the strength and condition guys, he has this ability to run these crazy high-speed meters. He'll run fast for you all day. And having those sort of players in broken field and if you create the right opportunities can be the difference between having cutting edge and not. You could play it a little bit safer with a Shane Daly potentially. And we know what Stockdale can do on the wing, but you know, can he convert all of that to fullback and reproduce some of his best form? But it doesn't feel as though we've got a plethora of options unless we take a little bit of a risk. And I'm pretty sure that Andy Farrell, based on what he's done previously, isn't going to do that in the first couple of games. Maybe there's an opportunity to do that in the Nations Cup or the November Test Series. As I'm not entirely sure what it's called, but it's maybe that you'll see more opportunity for guys, but Six Nations, they got to try and finish as high as they possibly can. The IRFU will be on in Andy's ear saying, we need as much dough as we possibly can. So further up that table, the better.
Is Chris Farrell on the wing a completely ridiculous idea?
I don't see it being a viable option, to be honest with you. He's not slow, but he's an out-and-out centre. You know, he's got a good skill set, and I'm sure, you know, he's got a good enough rugby brain if he got selected there to be able to deal with it. Would you be more inclined to play Chris Farrell at 13 and Gary Ringrose on the wing? I think probably feels as though he's got a bit more to his attacking game than Farrell does, more variancy to it. So I don't see how Chris Farrell on the wing is going to work.
Well, would Ringrose on the wing be pretty exciting?
It could be, but he's, you know, again, it's how often can you get the ball to him? You know, he's in a rich vein of form, just been named, you know, Leinster's player of the season last year. And he looks very confident in 13. He also is scoring an awful lot of tries from the 13 jersey. So do you want to take that away from him and maybe nullify the opportunities that he has gotten previously? I think you just have to be a bit careful with that. But sometimes, as I've mentioned previously, sometimes it's about getting your best players on the pitch. And that's how Shane Horgan found himself on the wing for Ireland all those years ago, is because, you know, the centres were already decided, you know, what's the next best player to get on the park? It's Shane Horgan. You know, can he play on the wing? He's never played there before, but sure enough, he became a winger thereafter. So good footballers are able to adjust to circumstances because they can read the game well, irrespective of what number's on their back. But it will take a bedding in process. And I wouldn't say that Farrell's incapable of playing on the wing, but I would imagine he doesn't have many aspirations to find himself out on the ding-a-ling.
All right. Good stuff, Brian. Thanks a million for joining us. Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.